Welcome to Books Boys, live from the Grand Library, the Dean and PJ.
Christmas special. He's PJ.
I'm the Dean, and we are the Books Boys.
The Books Boys, the one and only Books
Boys. This is the Books Boys show. Get it? Buy it?
Books.
Books. My
PJ,
God.
PJ, how are you?
Yeah, I'm doing very well, Dean. And but we're recording a bit early, the show, aren't we?
We are. We're recording early, and I'm not sure why, PJ. Is something happening around this time?
Well, yes, Dean. It's Christmas time. Merry Christmas!
Christmas? I've never heard of it ever.
Never heard of it.
Ah, dude, you must have heard of it. It's the latest thing. I mean, it's a scream on Apple Pie and Faceful and all that kind of stuff.
Is this a meme I can download, the Christmas?
I believe it's an app, yeah. I believe it's an app available on Google Play, but not on Huawei. And it's basically, you're supposed to get together with your loved ones, right?
Yeah.
But now it's all Zoom and all stuff anyway, so that's why it's an app, you see. And you're supposed to get together with your loved ones and just appreciate just life, you know? It's kind of very holy.
Did you know that today, we're recording actually on the 23rd, so about a week early. Did you know that today is actually Festivus? Do you know the Festivus?
No, what's the Festivus?
Festivus is the festival for the rest of us. So it's some kind of agnostic, fake joke festival. And your Christmas tree is a metal pole, and you wrestle your dad, and you tell everyone why you don't like them.
Right, okay. And do you read Anna Karenina's, agriculture manual part? Was it basically full book?
I assume so, because after you wrestle your dad, he's going to want to know the best farming techniques. So you're going to pull out the old Tolstoy, you know.
So a 19th century kind of, like, aristocratic wannabe farmer agriculture manual kind of thing. Eh?
I think so, yeah.
It's classic.
It's part of it.
It's very important, yeah. It's very
no,
important.
But PJ, I lied. I do know about Christmas.
What?
And in fact, we're joined on our recording. Last month we had Apollo. We got the Christmas mouse this month joining us in the live stream.
The Christmas mouse. Good Lord. I see him there, yeah. He's a bit off camera. I think he's a bit shy, but I can see his hat.
He's camera shy.
Well, bless him. So, Dean, what have you been reading this month? I know you've been reading a lot, so
This month I have gone into overdrive. I have read four complete novels.
Four novels? Okay, geez.
Four complete novels. I've started a fifth, but I'll talk about that next time. It's been a bit hectic, but I'm not going to discuss them all in detail, but the first two, they go very nicely together. So I did the month of B-sides. I picked some authors, I picked books that I wanted to read, and then I read different books instead. Why read the good ones, you know? So,
well, why read the good ones? The B-sides are always great, right?
Exactly. So we were thinking, you know, you might remember we talked about trying to read Madame Bovary by Flaubert. So I decided instead to read Sentimental Education.
Yeah, all right, okay.
And then I read Cousin Bet by Balzac.
Oh, I love a bit of Balzac.
Instead of the good one, old Goro. So
the famous one, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll be honest now, these two books, they're very, very similar. They're very similar, and it's very clear that there was influence, if not, I would say, almost blatant copying.
Right, and then Balzac came first, right? Having written
Balzac
probably
came
in
first,
the 1830s?
Cousin Bet's 1847.
47, oh, really, that late.
Sentimental Education's about 22 years later, I think, roughly.
Okay.
69, so summer of 69, but 100 years prior. And they were wild in that summer of 69, I tell you. Goodness gracious, the things in these books.
You've been telling me some things which would make any decent, you know, human just shiver. You know, shiver.
Well, I read them in the wrong order. I read the second one first. But I'm going to review them in the chronological order. So
yeah,
Cousin Bet was actually a really enjoyable book. To give it like the 30-second synopsis, Cousin Bet's not really the lead character, but it's about this guy and his family, and their cousin is Cousin Bet, and she's kind of a mischievous sort. She's got some plans. She doesn't like the fact that she's not important within the family. She wants to elevate her position. So she gets together with this girl who's a kind of... You know, I love the coquettes. You know, the flashy girls who just get the guys to give them everything they want. So she gets together with a coquette, and they just fleece the husband for all his money, basically. But it's really sad, because this is a tale with a heartwarming aspect, because the wife is the most downtrodden but loyal person I've ever seen in any book. No matter how many times she gets screwed over, no matter how badly she's treated. And we're talking about a husband who squanders all of their money, doesn't give her any food or leave her with anything to eat, has, you know, four different affairs, you know, just trashes her, basically. And she sticks with him loyally to the end, even when on her deathbed, he's still cheating on her. You know, it's just that heartwarming tale where you feel so, so sorry for the poor wife.
Right, okay.
That's really, and the husband never learns his lesson. He constantly says, I'm so sorry, I'm going to reform. And then he just goes right back to it.
Okay. That's a bit mad, right?
Sad. And we're talking about a guy who has four mistresses at different times. And, you know, he's giving them all of his money. He's in debt. He's giving them his pension, his salary. Like, he's got nothing to feed his family with.
So it's just kind of horrible. Like, it just sounds like nihilistic, basically. You're just completely brutal. I mean, is there anything nice about the story at all?
What's nice about it is that Cousin Bet doesn't really get what she wants in the end, without spoiling too much. Some of her goals do not come to fruition. And although the husband was not really a pleasant chap, there's something nice about the really put-upon wife and just the fact that she sticks with him the whole time.
Right.
And in an old-fashioned way, that's really respectable. I mean, nowadays, it would probably be seen as really anti-feminist. You know, the wife's virtue consists in the fact that she just takes garbage from this man over and over again and never leaves him, and that's really sad. But her strength of character, I mean, even the sort of hussies in the book describe her as a saint, and even though they're ruining her marriage, they really respect her because she's just this almost religious angel, this saintly character that they all respect for her virtue.
Okay.
So there is a nice aspect to it.
But I always enjoyed Old Père Goriot or Old Father Goriot, because I thought there's also very something funny about Balzac. And I can see that, you know, Balzac, he really influenced Dickens, because I think Balzac started writing just a bit before Dickens.
Just a little bit before Dickens.
And I can see the comedy there. I can see it. And a lot of these are like realist. They started realism in the 30s and 40s, talking about real society. But there's a lot of comedy in Dickens and in Balzac, and in a favorite one of mine was, I've told you, Benito Perez Galdós. So he's basically Spanish Dickens. He's basically Spanish Balzac. And he wrote later than both of them. So he's very much influenced, especially by Balzac. But I love the three of them. I would think of like the three, like the realists was humor. So I don't know about Cousin Bet, but I think maybe I can imagine that maybe the humor kind of sometimes left him, because he died in 1850, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And Balzac was always like drinking. He kind of lived a life of waking up just before the evening, drinking black coffee, and then just writing to the crack of dawn, just writing and then falling exhausted. I mean, he wasn't living a healthy life, was he? And he just died at 50. But, you know, don't know about if you noticed, Dean, but he fell in love with the Polish countess. And they couldn't get together for a long time because her husband died, and there was a thing about the heritage, and she wanted her daughter to get married to royalty again. And this would not work out if the mom married Balzac, et cetera, et cetera. And then at last they got together in 1849 or 50. And they were just married, I think, under a year, and then Balzac died. But I think he was happiest in the last year of his life. So, and this is before, this is after Cousin Bet. So I can imagine him maybe being very pessimistic around 1847.
Yeah, fair enough.
I think it's sweet that there is positivity then.
there is some positivity, and to be honest, it's a really enjoyable book. I only have one criticism of the book. It has no chapters. It's just a continuous story. And therefore, I was forced to read the whole thing in one day. Well, a day and a half. Because I didn't know when to stop. There were no chapters, so I just kept reading.
Right, okay. Okay, well, that's like a continuous flow then, isn't it? That's kind of very experimental as well for the time.
It caught me off guard. I thought I'll read the first chapter today and then I'll stop. And then I was, you know, 300 pages in and I had to go to sleep.
That's unusual for the times as well. Yeah, it sounds like Ulysses from James Joyce or something.
So, PJ, the other book that I read then is, as I say, very similar. It's the Flaubert book, Sentimental Education. And in a sense, it's the same book. They just flip the gender. So they flip the male and the female. And this time, I mean, here's a curious point, and I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, but regardless of whether it's the man who's going out having four affairs or the woman who's going out having four affairs, I always feel like the men come across like the bad guys, and I always feel sympathy for the women.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think it'd be easier if that probably just has to do with the fact that as a heterosexual man, you just obviously go into like forgive the woman more, maybe, right? And maybe be like also like Balzac being a heterosexual man also, he possibly portrayed the woman in so like the same action, but I feel like the woman can get away with it easier than the man, just because or at least she's doing it with elegance, maybe something like that. And that I think I feel like that's a perceptive thing. I wonder what a woman, at least a heterosexual woman, would think about this. Would she find more compassion with the man? Because remember, we were talking about the Bronte sisters, and I feel like particularly Wuthering Heights, it's like, why is she so forgiving toward Heathcliff? You know, why? He's such an asshole, you know? I feel like maybe it's the woman or the professor, right? Not the or was it Villette? All these kind of woman authors portraying man.
Yeah. Well, the professor kind of fed into Villette, so that the professor was the one that she couldn't get published, so she just reused it in Villette.
So if you think about that sense, like, it's just a woman seems to just be, it's kind of sweet. So like a woman is just wants to forgive the man. There's something sweet about it too. You know, a woman wants to forgive the man more easily than a man. And I feel like a heterosexual man just can't forgive the man. It's just like, he just finds it. I feel like the heterosexual man just finds the mean man disgusting. But a woman would find, like, try to find him as a damned creature who just needs some love, you know?
Maybe.
Perspective.
Well, in both books, we do have men having most of the affairs, but unlike that amazing coquette who's, you know, just going from one guy to another, fleecing them for all their money, in this book, in Sentimental Education, it's the reverse. We do see the male character living off women and taking their savings and taking their money. But the poor chap, he has four girlfriends at once, but he keeps telling them, oh, but you're the only one, I'm going to move in with you. But then he tells the next one, I'm going to marry you. So at one point, he's engaged to one girl whilst he's living with another, whilst he's got a third one pregnant, whilst he's telling the fourth one that he's going to go with her. And it's like, dude, you can't, what is going on? You know, the lack of morality, I don't know.
Well, imagine being in that dilemma. You're engaged to one, living together with another, was it? And then having a child with another, and then flirting around was the fourth one.
Yeah.
It's quite,
I think the fourth one was paying his expenses or something. You know what it was like. You need to have a kind of sugar mummy, I don't know.
Okay. Jesus, this is crazy. It's
but
mad. Okay.
The weird thing is, when it's this way around, I was really sad reading the book. I didn't enjoy this one. It was too much for me. I didn't feel any empathy or sympathy or liking of any kind for the lead character. This one took a bit longer to read because it had chapters, so I was able to pause. I don't know when to stop until they tell me, you know. But I don't know. This one, it just made me quite sad, and it doesn't have any redeeming features. So they just copy and paste the story. They flip the gender, but they took away the saintly character, the redeeming feature. So it's just sad and angry, and then it ends.
And that's interesting, because if that came later, you know, realism evolved into naturalism with Emile Zola in the late 19th century. And, you know, so naturalism is this literary movement where you're still portraying society sort of realistically, but I suppose now it's becoming a bit of almost like a farce. You're just showing the real, real dark side of society. It's not really realistic anymore. It's just because you're just focusing on the real gritty, grim side of society. And I feel like that the way you describe Sentiment Education is like a transition between realism and and naturalism, because as soon as you, if you read Nana, for example, from Zola, it's like you just feel so depressed because it's like you can't believe this is happening to her, or the horrible things. It's just, you know, grim as hell.
Yeah.
So the French
I finished this one, because I read this one first, don't forget, I really wasn't sure if I could face the second one because I thought this is rough. I don't know if I can cope with that again. But I did think that Balzac's style was just a little bit more polished, and there was just that good character in there that made me enjoy it a little bit more.
And don't forget, it's part of the big serious, you know, La Comédie Humaine, so like the human comedy.
Yes.
It's like so many. So for you guys listening, this is, I think he wrote this in the span of what, like 30 something years. Just writing,
basically throughout his entire writing life,
It's just basic, but it's just considered one kind of universe because they are interlinked. So like characters keep appearing in and out of them, and so they're not really separate. Yeah, so they're just share the same French universe of the time. And but yeah, it is called, like, you know, the human comedy. You know, like as a reference to Dante. You know, not the divine comedy, but the human comedy. So it is always has these comedic elements. And yeah, Balzac is a very pleasant writer. I find him very, I just can empathize with him and with his characters, even though they're kind of often idiotic characters as well, but you can really empathize with them.
Well, I have a point to make, and I have a question.
Yeah.
The question first, because obviously I still want to read Madame Bovary. I really hope that Flaubert's a little bit more upbeat in Madame Bovary. I don't know if I can take another one like that.
Oh, Lord. Well, I know we want to read Madame Bovary together, but I'm honestly expecting the same as Anna Karenina, because I believe they're similar tragic stories. But I also hear that Madame Bovary was influenced by the book I'm still reading, Don Quixote. So, which makes me hope, like, oh, if it's influenced by Don Quixote, it can't be too dark like Anna Karenina, you know? So I don't know. I'm still up for reading it, though.
It's quite a short book, though, so I think they forgot to include 600 pages.
I know.
And that was a clear oversight. Obviously, it was intended. They just forgot.
Ah, no, you can't be doing that. You can't. Look, all these novels that are that short, they're missing their agriculture manual. I said it before, you know, you got to do it.
It's a shame. But the point that I had to make, so that was the question. The point is, these two books, because they're set in Paris, mostly, I don't know how I feel about Paris. I remember myself in Montmartre with the caricature artists and the jazz music, literally weeping from this ecstatic joy. And I think of Paris when I watch Audrey Hepburn movies with them strolling along the Seine with, I don't know, Cary Grant or whoever was in some of those movies with her. And these are beautiful movies, and I have this amazing idea of Paris. And these books did for Paris, kind of like what Dickens did for London, only about 1,000 times worse. They destroyed it for me.
Yeah.
And that is really, really sad. I don't know how I feel now. It's they've taken the romance away with gritty, I mean, realism, as you say, but then actually taken so far that it's almost not realistic anymore. It's
like
almost depressing.
Yeah, I mean, I know what you mean, yeah. Also, like, because I feel like all these writers are very socialist, you know, kind of, they have socialist tendencies, so they're obviously realist, but like more like we're just going to show you the real, like the real society that's not shown in you know, in books.
Yeah.
But that means it's not 100% realist either, as you say. I feel like that is not 100% realist. That's just like more like social kind of realist.
It was too much for me. We know that I'm only 2% realistic. It was too much for me.
Oh yeah, you did that test recently, didn't you, Dean? Yeah.
But do you know what I had to do? What I had to do, PJ, for my third book, I was gonna read The Mill on the Floss or The Floss on the Mill or whichever way around it goes. And I just thought, no, I'm gonna have to do something that I know I can trust. So I turned to my good old friend Wilkie Collins, Dickens deputy. I read After Dark. Now, After Dark It's a little bit shorter. It's in and around the 300 to 400 pages. You know, it's a little bit shorter. And it's not really a novel. It's a series of short stories.
Huh.
Having said that, two of the stories are 100 pages, and then there's a framing device. So there's a painter who goes around painting people's portraits. And each of the people he paints, they tell him a story. And this is him publishing a collection of stories.
Right.
So the framing device takes a few pages, and then two of the stories take 100 pages each. So that's like two-thirds of the book gone. And then there's just a few little short stories that are kind of worthless, you know, smattered in around it. But the two main stories are quite enjoyable, and it's just a really nice book. Hmm. Wilkie Collins, it's almost as if you're reading Dickens, but it's just not quite as good, but it's set in the same world. And nothing against Wilkie Collins. I love him. I love The Moonstone. It's the first proper kind of crime book, if you will. I love, Woman in White was a bit dull. But, you know, I do like Wilkie Collins. The two main stories, the two kind of long ones, are The Yellow Mask, which is essentially about this guy and his wife is dead. But then he sees a girl in a yellow mask, and then it turns out that, you know, it's his dead wife, but then it's not really. There's always a ghost story element in some of Wilkie Collins' work.
Yeah.
He did a lot of ghost stories together with Dickens. And it's quite an interesting story about them just trying to find out, you know, who is it in the yellow mask? Who turned up to this ball in the yellow mask? We need to find who is this girl. But they're always uplifting. They have happy endings. They're nice. They're happy. They're not depressing. And this was just what I needed. And then the other one, the other long one was called Sister Rose. So they tell a story. They find a crucifix and they say, well, who's that from? Oh, it's a relic from Sister Rose, and they tell the story of her. But it's the usual sort of heart-rending stuff, you know, your kind of Victorian stuff. I mean, it's very typical. It's not anything special. It's nothing amazing. It's not worth kind of analyzing in any detail. But it was just a nice collection of little stories that made me feel happy after some of the kind of rougher elements of the Parisian literature.
You know, I feel like... you know, literature is often like, you know, you want to be like, some people just say, oh, I only read classics. And the other one's like, oh, I only read for pleasure. I don't, you know, I'm going to read the next Maeve Binch novel or whatever. And then, but the other person like, oh, well, I'm going to read Ulysses. So F you kind of. But I feel like I really enjoy everything. You know, I feel like I could, like, if I had a list, well, I do have a list, you know, but it's always changing. But my list of like, say, top 20 novels will include a lot of sort of kind of pulp fiction with whatever you call it, high literature and stuff like that, and everything between that, and there is all kinds of stuff between that. And I feel like, yeah, I mean, what, so what? So it's obviously not like a high class high literature novel like Sentimental Education, but if it's a well-written novel, you see, I think a well-written novel deserves more praise than like, you know, a long, tedious novel that just makes you feel empty in the end. I feel like there are a lot of overrated novels that are taught in school, for example, you know.
So yeah.
I mean, like, that sounds, because in the end, I want to read the latter two books you just mentioned more than the first two books. Although I love Balzac, but you really killed Sentimental Education. I don't want to read it after you tell me that, you know.
Mm.
It's like, and that's supposed to be like a classic. So it's interesting that sometimes it's just not the classics you want to read. Sometimes it's just, you know, something. And also, like, I'm also a big defender of, like, the little guys, you know what I mean? I love to find a novelist who wasn't that well known and read that novel that's been forgotten. Like that book we both love, the one in Barcelona, what's it called again, dude? The Shadow of the Wind. Carlos Ruiz Zafón.
La Sobre el Viento, yes.
La Sobre el Viento, yeah. Another great book, right? So, like, basically about a boy, like, finding a forgotten book. It's a library of forgotten books. I mean, I love
library
that.
Library of forgotten books.
So you mentioning those two novels is great because those two novels will probably be forgotten. You know what I mean? They're already almost forgotten. They will be forgotten. And then you just left with Sentimental Education, leaving everyone depressed. Mm. Well, the Sentimental Education might be great for someone else. But it's also great to mention the little kind of books, you know.
Yeah.
Love that. Love that you did that.
The Sister Rose one was nice because some of the stuff is hijinks. You know, there's a guy and he's pretending to be some kind of count and she marries him and then he's not really who he said he was. And then it's a bit of hijinks. But the girls are always in this travesty. They're always like, oh no, my reputation will be destroyed. And there's a lot of that, you know, how can I ever live again when I've been duped? And I do like a little bit of the drama, the almost completely needless drama caused by strict Victorian morals. But you remind me of a point. Sentimental Education, here's the main reason I was upset. Listen to that title, and also the first chapter or so made me think, are they going to educate me in an artistic, sentimental way? They're going to talk about love of the arts and literature and music, and this is the kind of education he's getting. No, it was absolutely not that at all. I was totally off when I thought that's what I was going to read.
Oh, for God's sake, yeah. No, that's also
very, very quickly, I'll take 2 minutes on this one. The very last book I read is a very, very short book. We're talking 250 pages, but we're talking small pages with big text. This is a new segment, Guilty Pleasure Books. This is my guilty pleasure. It's The Apartment by K.L. Slater.
Okay.
There's a series of these kind of books. They're always quite short. They're guilty pleasures. They're always, you know, two initials and a surname. They're always usually a poor woman and a sneaky, mischievous man who's tricking her because he's charming and handsome. They're written for that kind of audience. But you know what? They're not super well written. There's one or two words that were used wrongly or phrases that weren't quite right. But they're really, really good, really addictive kind of books. And I read this in, a day and a half, maybe 2 days, because it's a page-turner.
Yeah.
It's just about this girl and her daughter. And there's a lot of mother instincts in these kind of books as well. But she moves into an apartment that she can't afford because the guy gives her a splendid deal. But then it turns out there's a lot of weird stuff in the apartment and they're seeing things and they're hearing things and there's a lot of manipulation. Right. And actually, they're in part of some kind of social experiment, basically.
Okay.
And that's why they're in the apartment. They're essentially lab rats for a psychology experiment. But it's a really, really good book. And obviously, these books always end with, you know, the someone tries to kill her or whatever. They're mysteries at the same time, but they throw in the twists that you never see coming, and they're really good books. So this is one that I really actually would recommend, and you can read it in, like, you know, 10 minutes or a day or whatever.
And that's why I said, right? I mean, this is not a famous person, or I've never heard of him or personally this person.
Never and in
it's
my
not,
life.
But it's nice that you kind of saved this person from oblivion and this book, especially, right?
So I mean, apparently she's famous now, like, not a classic, but she sold a million copies to, you know, I don't know, to 40-year-old mums or whoever's reading this, but, you know, it's good.
Yeah, well, that's great, dude, yeah.
So, dude, that's so much from me. People are so sick of hearing my voice. The complaints for the show are actually already coming in before we've even released the show. They said you're talking too much. So
I heard only beautiful things.
You're still working your way through... through Cervantes, right?
To Don Quixote. And first of all, I've been hearing other comments, Dean. Very, very, very lovely voice, yeah. I've been reading through. So I've not been reading that much this month. So I've been kind of stuck with other things. I've been just blissfully busy with other things. And yeah, I really loved Don Quixote still, reading it slowly, enjoying it. But I've also been reading some poetry. So today I want to tell you a bit about poetry. Because we talked about novels, and this is a poet I know personally. She's a friend of my dad. Became my friend as well. And she's from Belfast. Her name is Eileen O'Neill, or Eileen T. O'Neill is the way she. And here are the two books, just showing you, Dean. They're lovely books. I mean, I'm not sure how she got them published. They almost look like she designed them themselves, and they're quite short. And this is her first one, Reason Without Rhyme,
yeah?
Reason Without Rhyme, yeah. And the second one is 57 Pebbles. And she also uses her own photography. So it's what I like about these two books is that it's full with photography. And we're just talking about this the other day, like illustrations. I really enjoy illustrations in a book, even in an adult book, because there's like some kind of misconception of photos. There's some kind of misconception of photos in a book is cheap. And that illustrations in the book is childish. And it's like, well, what are you talking about? You know, it's beautiful. So these
of course,
really...
I mean, even the Dickens always has illustrations in his books. It doesn't have to be childish at all.
That's what I mean. So, I mean, it's just, it's great. Or, I mean, like, the Little Prince would not be the same without the illustrations, for example. And this was given to me as a gift by Eileen herself. So it's very sweet as a Christmas present. And I've read her poetry before, but obviously very different reading in book format. We talked about this. So for all of you listening, obviously, you know, reading from the internet is very useful and cheap. But don't forget, first of all, that, you know, you want to support those authors and maybe just buy the book. You should be supporting the author and the industry. And it's just such a different experience, right? Reading the book. And you can just buy it secondhand as well, cheap. So you can just buy it secondhand, and it's such a big difference.
PJ, I've met Eileen O'Neill, right, in Burt's Jazz Lounge.
Indeed you have, Dean. Indeed you have. So we met her both on the same day. So that's her. So, and she's an amazing person. I've been in contact with her during quarantine. And in fact, I'd like to introduce to you a song. So my dad wrote this song. Sorry, my dad composed this song using Eileen O'Neill's poetry, basically. And he adapted it into a song. And it's basically, yeah, it's basically, it only came to existence because of the lockdown. And they started working together. So he was reading a lot of her poetry. And yeah, and he just said, why don't we work together? So if you want, we can put up this song.
Lily's Lament, right?
Lily's Lament, right. And the lyrics are by Eileen O'Neill, as I said, adapted by Kieran Burke. So that's actually my dad. And yeah, so do you want to just put it on there?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's cue it up. DJ, spin that record.
Spin that record.
Play a concertina, breathe a breath. as I gaze into night's galaxy of awe. Blind or not, for you are not alone. There's prosper in your repair.
Well, that was a good one.
Yeah, well, I hope you enjoyed that. Anyway,
there's a whole album in the works, right?
Yeah, it should be coming out next week. So we guys can let you know when it's out. Or could be coming out in 2 weeks.
Depending. So listeners, when you're listening in the future, it could already be out.
It could already be out, actually, yeah. So coming out any second now. And let me just talk to you a bit why I like her poetry. So when I read her poems, they're very short, first of all. They're very brief. And I write poetry myself, and I do enjoy a nice brief poem because it's a bit like reading a brief novel. Sometimes you just want to like read something light and not too loquacious.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's like the fourth novel you mentioned. It's just that such a relief reading, you know, not having to read Odyssey or Iliad. It just goes on and on. You just want to read the poem and then like move on, and it's like reading a short story. And yeah, her themes are very sort of personal. They're about they're about memories, about her impressions. She writes daily, so daily she writes a poem, and it's always like something that's on her mind, basically. So obviously there are a lot of poems about Brexit, a lot of poems about travel. She's been a lot about her family as well.
Okay, so these aren't always super romantic poems. They're more daily, they're more realistic, right?
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, the poetry doesn't have to be romantic at all, and that's a lot of people think that. In fact, I don't really read that many romantic poems here. So, particular reason was that rhyme. That's the one I've been getting really into. I'm taking my time. And so that's the first book. And if you like, I can read out one of the poems. There are a few I like, but I'm going to read out one for you guys. So, and I thought this one was particularly... poignant. I'll tell you why in a second, because I want to read out first and then I'll explain to you what I think this poetry means. And yeah, then just have a listen to it as well and see what you think as well. So here it is. It's from the book Reason Without Rhyme. It's called Recognizing Absence. I often wonder if you can see me right now, reminiscing as I lovingly remember you. Recognizing all those years of separation, where life was left behind and moved on. Those many moments of yearning for you, especially since your absence is most profound. I miss seeing your smiling blue eyes of welcome. Your familiar voice is consigned to yesteryear. I miss your warm embrace and our cozy times. Most of all, I miss you because you were my mom. So there you go. That's the poem, Recognizing Absence.
No, you swindled me there, because that was very good, but you did read a romantic one.
I don't know if that's romantic, though, to be honest. Not in the classic couple sense. That's what I mean.
It's not love.
Yeah.
No.
Fair enough. She's maybe romantic, like, in the kind of literary sense. I feel like, yeah, there is a very much kind of like contemplating death, contemplating love as well, but contemplating friendship. Yeah, I suppose she's a romanticist, but not like romantic in this sort of kind of Hollywood sense. Yeah.
Now, do you remember about a million years ago for Halloween, I was Dracula and you were a romantic poet?
I was indeed, yeah.
See, there we go. Callbacks. One thing I forgot to do, which I always do, is read a quote from one of my books, and you just reminded me. And I didn't take very many this time. I only took one tiny little quote, but it's one that I like anyway.
Okay, go ahead.
When Fabio arrived at the palace, the jovial uproar in the heavy department was at its height, and several gentlemen, fired by the classical costumes of the shepherdesses, were beginning to speak Latin to them with a thick utterance and a valorous contempt for all restrictions of gender, number, and kiss. So it goes on, they seek a quieter room. But I love this. Going out to the disco, going out to the nightclub, dressed as a sneaky little shepherdess, and all the guys flirt with you by speaking Latin, you know? Bring that.
That is cool, yeah. Something that just doesn't exist anymore, right? It's that kind of capturing the moment of the time, kind of.
I love and it. PJ, before we go any further, it's time to hear from this month's sponsor.
Oh.
Now, we're a little bit late because people are going to listen after Christmas. But if you're struggling to get Christmas presents, or maybe for next year or for birthdays or whatever, you can buy yourself the new range of plush toys, the teddies. It's the Dostoyev teddy. How would you like a teddy bear of Dostoyevsky?
You're joking.
You can get it right now, dostoyevteddy.gov. All you got to do is order the teddy, and it will teach your little ones about crime and punishment and religious politics.
Right. Okay. I'm looking forward
to it. Comes with phrases. Press the button, says some phrases from the religious politics. Quotes whole pages at a time. It's great for the little ones. And it's, you know, only, you know, 20, 30 pounds in that kind of range, so.
Right, okay. Well, that sounds very good. What about the Toaster Bear? Is that coming out soon?
Toaster Bear's coming out too. That's the second one. You got to get them both. Okay. £50 for two.
Wow, and imagine the kid comes out just as a pessimistic sort of expert in religion and agriculture, no? Yeah, I think that's the future, yeah? So get it,
very
guys.
Very important, and I worry about our education system. I don't think we teach the kids enough about Tsarist Russian agriculture. I really think that we're letting them down.
I think you're absolutely right. I think you're absolutely right, Dean. And Dean, that's
a real shame.
That reminds me that are we not going to give also just a book recommendation?
We are indeed.
For Christmas time.
You have a recommendation there, PJ.
I have several recommendations. I'm just thinking for Christmas time, I have to say that I'd like to recommend a nice little book that I've read twice or thrice, and it's by Neil Gaiman. He's an English author who writes, they say he writes more for teenagers, but really, no, it's like saying that The Little Prince is for teenagers. They're very deep books, but easy to read. And he wrote American Gods, was not at all for teenagers, and it's a big hit on Netflix. I don't know about the series. Read the book, American Gods. It's epic. But the one I really recommend for Christmas time is a nice little book called Coraline. Have you heard of this, Dean?
I haven't heard of it at all, no.
Well, look, it's a sweet novel. It's being compared to, Alice in Wonderland. It's that kind of, perhaps, it's slightly surreal without getting flippant, you know what I mean? So it's kind of like there's a sense of there is more than surreal. It's just a feeling of being kind of between a state of dreaming and awakening. I think some people find the book creepy. There's also a great stop motion film, which I really love as well. I think it's a great adaptation. So either watch the stop motion film by Henry Selick, Coraline, or read the book. And they're a bit different, and they're both great. And what I recommend is it's a book you read in one day. It's only 186 pages, more or less, but like big print. And this is aimed for children, but there's something so amazing about the story. It's basically about her entering. She goes through a room, and she enters her second home, which is kind of like a mirror. It's a twisted mirror image of her real home, where everyone wears buttons for eyes. And at first, she just really loves it, actually. She's very, very magical. And it's like her parents, all of a sudden, like the button-eyed parents, they take care of her and like just want to be with her, whereas her real parents are just too busy and kind of absent.
Right.
And it goes really effed up and dark, actually. It's a really dark. It's not at all. It's for kids. And it, actually, no, you shouldn't be reading it as a kid. It's that kind of book. It's in the end, it's a children's horror fiction book, and at the same time there's something very Christmassy about it, so it's completely unique. Highly recommend it, and it's lovely illustrated. So again, I'm very fond of the illustrated books at the moment, and really recommend it. Caroline by Neil Gaiman.
PJ, I love it. That sounds amazing. You've really pulled it back after recommending, you know, Batman versus Superman or some garbage.
Oh right, yeah. You weren't too enthused about that, yeah. So I feel like you might read this one, yeah. By the way, that book I got in the Magic Bookshop in Belfast. So if anyone, again, guys, owned by a magician. No. You go ahead. Actually, what's your recommendation? Sure. No, I actually want to.
My recommendation is, if you know me, then it's a stereotype of me, but it's A Christmas Carol by Dickens. How could it not be?
How
I haven't harped on about Dickens much on these three episodes, but he is my all-time favorite author. I think he takes the novel as far as it can go. I think he's just absolutely amazing. And A Christmas Carol is not really a novel. It's about 50 or 60 pages. It'd be quicker to read it than it would be to watch a film adaptation.
Yeah, starring you.
And everyone knows the story, so I'm not going to tell you about the story and the ghosts and everything. But it's just a lovely little read. I'll be honest, Dickens also wrote a lot of Christmas stories, some of them with Wilkie Collins. And he also wrote four other Christmas novellas, The Chimes and can't remember the others. None of them are really that good. Nowhere near as good as his actual full-length novels. But the exception is, of course, A Christmas Carol, which is one of the greatest, you know, stories ever written. I really, really recommend just taking the time. As I say, you could read it in an hour. Just everybody, you can probably get it online if you don't want to buy the book. You know, it's only an hour worth of reading. Just everybody try to enjoy A Christmas Carol. Dickens basically reinvented. I know there was a film recently, The Man Who Invented Christmas, and obviously that's not true. But he did kind of reinvent and modernize it. He gave us that idea of giving presents to the children and, you know, all the rest of it. So I do think it's worth reading.
Okay, awesome. So those are two short books. So maybe if you're new to the world of books, they're good ones. And they're both kind of fitting for kind of younger readers as well, right? Possibly.
I'd say so, yeah. This is ghosts, yeah, so but it's not scary.
Exactly, and saying Coraline, it's a children's book, but there's something very adult about it too. So, we recommend that, guys. Well, all right, and Dean, I believe we have to finish up something very special coming up, right?
We do indeed. We're gonna play a Christmas song, and I don't know how I'm gonna do this. We're gonna do it spontaneous and live. I'm gonna turn on my automatic voice harmonizer, and I'm gonna somehow do some harmonies live in person. So we'll see how that goes. PJ, which is the song that we're going to play?
So the song we're going to sing live is the fantastic, the only, the magnificent, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. There you go. That's the name of the song.
There we go.
It's not a song. It's a new song, guys. So, you know. Yeah.
It's cool with the kids. All the kids they thought they were listening to... I don't know what a kid's listen to, Britney Spears or something, but no, they're listening to the King's Church Choir doing this. So there
exactly.
You go.
Exactly. And by the way, Dean, I think the kids that listen to Britney Spears are now mothers and dads. You know what I mean? I think that's a bit. I don't think that's what the kids are listening to. Actually, they're probably listening to like, I don't know, like to barking hound dog, Joe.
It's
or something.
It's like what's cool now, Rosalia, right? Trap music. Trap's cool.
Trap music, all right, yeah.
Trap's cool. I made a trap song once. I think trap's what the kids are listening to. I don't know. I'm too old, and I don't know. I'm old before my time. I have no idea what they're... The hip-hop, I guess. Basketball is my favorite sport. Do you know that hip-hop song?
No, I don't know.
One of the early hip-hop songs from the 80s. Basketball is my favorite sport. We can dribble up and down the court. Amazing.
Wow, sounds good.
Let's take... few seconds each, but we did this for Halloween and I think we'll do it again for Christmas. If you have one, do you have not a book but a Christmas film recommendation?
Christmas film recommendation, what would I watch during Christmas? Can it be a series or does it have to be a film?
Yeah, no, whatever you want.
Now I'm gonna say like Frasier. I'm not sure if I ever like we've talked so much about Frasier, but like for me it's like my dad got me into Frasier and it's the ultimate comfort series. Do love Father Ted. It's very close, but Frasier in the end is just absolutely just. It's completely innocent and comforting, and it's very sweet. I recommend that. Just any episode from Frasier. Well, preferably season 1 to 5, and then the last season is great too. But in the middle goes down a bit.
My recommendation is Miracle on 34th Street. I've only seen the 90s version, and I don't know if that makes me some kind of modern hipster. Because I know there is a black and white version from the 40s, but it's a really lovely story. It's one of the classic Christmas films. It's perfectly in that blend where it's not some garbage Netflix romantic film that isn't really a Christmas film. They just put it at Christmas time. But it's also not a silly kids film either. It has Santa in it. It is a real Christmas film, but it's not just for kids, and it has some romance, and it's very 90s and lovely. So that's my recommendation. PJ, we've got to go because I've got to go now do some paperwork for my court case because we did a pilot episode 2 months ago. I didn't apply for our pilot's license before we did it.
What?
Being taken to court for that, so I've got to go work on that. And then we got to come back and record the Bufanda Boys. Work for the remake of this show, but with scarves, right?
But you have to sponsor, guys. You know, I have to sponsor, otherwise you're not getting that Bufanda Boys.
Just send us all your money, and you can hear the same show again, but we'll wear scarves.
Exactly. So that's the main thing.
PJ, have yourself a Merry Christmas.
Have a Merry Christmas to you.
And a Happy New Year.
The same to you. And Merry Christmas to all of you. And a Happy New Year.
We are going to take you out with the song we mentioned. And we'll be back next month for another episode of Books Boys.
Oh, yeah. See you, guys. Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas. Ho, 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 ho.
And don't forget, email us. Booksboys@hotmail.com or leave a comment on our blog. And tell us what you've been reading for a chance to win a mystery book.
Blueberry.
This podcast is a member of the Blueberry Network. Blueberry. That's Blueberry, BLUBRRY.com.
Blueberry, with no E's. Remember, you drop the E's.
PJ, what's this new reindeer fellow all the kids are talking about?
You know Dasher and Dancer and Prancer and Vixen.
Yes, yes.
Comet and Cupid and Donner and Blitzen.
Of course.
But do you recall the most famous reindeer of all?
There's another? I never heard of him ever. Can you tell me about him?
Rudolph had no reindeer, had their shiny nose. And if you ever saw,
it glows.
It glows? All the other reindeer used to laugh and call him names. They never let poor Rudolph join any reindeer games. Then one foggy Christmas Eve, Santa came to say,
Rudolph, with your nose so bright, won't you guide my sleigh tonight?
Here
we do it together, guys. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, you'll go down in history. So we had Dasher, Dancer, Prancer, Vixen, Comet, Cupid, Donner, and Blitzen. And now this new little fellow, the Rudolph, right? Tell me one more time.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer had a very shiny nose, and if you ever saw it, you would even say it glows.
It glows!
All of the other reindeer used to laugh and call him names. They never let poor Rudolph join in any reindeer game.
But then what happened?
Then one foggy Christmas Eve, Santa came to say,
Rudolph, with your nose so bright, won't you guide my sleigh?
Then how the reindeer loved him as they shouted out with glee,
Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer, you'll go down in history. Books Boys was presented by The Dean and PJ Burke in association with Thaddeus Penguin Productions. This episode was brought to you by our sponsor,
The Dostoyev Teddy.
If you would like to get in touch, you can email us at booksboys@hotmail.com or visit us at booksboys.blogspot.com. The intro uses Driving in the 70s from the Of Soundtracks and Garage Bands EP by Trapdoor. and the outro uses Dog's Light by Bravo Marx from the album of the same name. All music used is either Podsafe or used with permission. Thank you kindly for listening to us. Please tell your friends and come back next time for another episode of Books Boys.
Read some books!
What's it called, dude? It's called Ding Dong Ding?
Ding Dong.
Ah, for fuck's sake, man. It's like, I just don't get the song. Like, I just don't get it. Like, Ding Dong Merrily on a High. Like, I've never heard of the song.
Really? Man, it's a classic. It's hundreds of years old. Ding Dong.
Okay.
Okay, let's do Rudolph instead.